Welcome to The Philosopher's Nest. I'm Kyle Van Ostrom.
And I'm Lewis Williams.
The Philosopher's Nest is a podcast that showcases the work, insights, and experiences of graduate students in philosophy. This podcast is generously supported by the American Philosophical Association, the Faculty of Philosophy at the University of Oxford, and Lineker College, Oxford.
Today, we're going to be joined by Cindy Friedman, a PhD student at Utrecht University. We'll be talking about Cindy's experiences as a PhD student in the Netherlands, as well as her research on the ethics of humanoid robots. If you'd like to get in touch with Cindy, you can reach her via email at c.friedman@uu.nl, and you can also find her on LinkedIn and on ResearchGate.
Cindy Friedman, welcome to the Philosopher's Nest.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you mentioned that as an undergrad, you did philosophy, politics, and economics, which is a great degree, but you were drawn more towards philosophy. So what was it that drew you away from politics, economics, and towards philosophy in particular?
Well, I don't know if I was so much drawn away from politics and economics. I think I was just drawn much more to philosophy. I just think as an undergrad who was experiencing university for the first time, I just enjoyed the classes that much more. I really enjoyed the discussions. I particularly enjoyed ethics, for example, and all these really controversial gray areas that we often found ourselves in within these class discussions. And I don't know, I guess it just spoke to me a little bit more. As for economics and politics, I enjoyed it as well. There were also very interesting conversations that happened in those classrooms as well. But yeah, it was just the pure enjoyment factor. I just looked forward going to classes, as nerdy as that sounds, I guess.
I felt the same way. Ethics was my first love in philosophy as well. When did the ethics of AI emerge as an interest for you? Was that during your undergrad, or was that something you came to a little bit later?
No, that was only much later. So in South Africa, we have your three-year undergraduate degree, which was my PPE. And I figured, okay, you know, this university thing is kind of cool. I'm enjoying it. Like, you know, let's take it a step further. And when you finish your three-year undergraduate degree, then before you do a master's, you'll have to do a one-year honors program. I was very, you know, undecided because I knew, okay, I need to make these kind of practical decisions about a direction that will hopefully, you know, get me a job one day, which is kind of important, you know. But I really enjoyed philosophy, but I was a little bit unsure about the kind of future careers that I could have with philosophy. I think this is a conversation that all philosophers really have with themselves at some point or another. I was speaking to one of our professors about this, and she told me about a funding opportunity that was available for ethics in AI. And it was just this perfect combination because, as I mentioned, I really, really enjoyed ethics and enjoyed a lot of the discussions that were happening within our classroom that had to do with ethics. But then knowing kind of what was going on with AI and all these general discussions that were happening in the news and all these things, and, you know, it just seemed like a way to combine this interest in philosophy and ethics with something that just seemed more practically applied, something that could hopefully lead to a pretty solid career one day. So I only found that, I think in about 2018 was when I started delving into that.
Great. And this PhD that you're doing in ethics of AI, you're doing in the Netherlands, which is the country where I'm from. Do you think there's anything unique about doing a PhD in the Netherlands versus somewhere like the UK or the US? I take it European PhDs have this sort of team element working in a research group that's sort of perhaps less common in the United States and the United Kingdom.
Yeah, so there is definitely this team dynamic, which was also really new to me because it's not something that is really the case in South Africa either. So to be completely honest, when I started this PhD, I didn't really know much about what I was getting into aside from kind of who I was going to be directly working with and the topic and everything. So it kind of took me a while to get used to this group dynamic. But it's really amazing because you kind of enter this really amazing network of people that are doing similar research. So, you know, these networking opportunities are kind of handed to you on a golden platter in a sense. So that is one difference. Definitely, it's less isolating. But what I really value about doing a PhD in the Netherlands is the fact that you're a full-time employee. So you're working full-time, you have a contract, you're getting your salary every month, you're getting your bonuses as well. And obviously, you know, the financing is really amazing and we're really lucky here. But the nice thing is that it really gives you the opportunity to, at least for me, it has helped me create this good work-life balance, I think. Where I really see this as a job that I'm working at, you know, for 8 hours of the day. I go to the office, I do what I need to do, I get paid, and then I come home. And then I often do things that are not related to philosophy or directly related to my research ID. So I think in that sense, it's a really mental health-wise, I think it gives you the opportunity to really have this very good balance.
In the UK, there's quite clear distinctions between the PhD student, the postdoctoral researcher, and then the lecturer or assistant professor, whatever the label they're going by. Under your description of what the life of a PhD student is like in the Netherlands, I wonder if that somewhat deflates the distinction between the PhD student and the postdoctoral researcher, you know, being employed on a contract, working on a specific project. Does that fit with your experience?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's less hierarchical in general. I think, look, every university is different, but at least at Utrecht University, where I'm based, the PhDs and the postdocs have this co-working area where we all work together and we all have lunch together and we all talk about our research together. So there's this kind of coherent group dynamic between the PhDs and the postdocs, but even between the assistant professors and the associate professors and the full professors, there's still this non-hierarchical dynamic, which is really nice because I think as a PhD, it kind of builds your confidence because you feel like you have the same safe space in a way to interact with people, whether it just be about everyday things or open up about your research ideas or your struggles. So in that sense, yeah, it does kind of deflate those roles in a way, but I think it's a very positive dynamic.
I think we've heard broadly similar things about the experience of the PhD student at European universities from other doctoral students we've had from other European unis come on the podcast as well. But I'm interested in one thing that you said a moment ago about not quite knowing what you could expect when you made that step from your undergrad and master's in South Africa to beginning your doctoral studies in the Netherlands. Because I think perhaps this relates to something that we spoke about a little bit earlier, about your experiences as not just being a first-generation PhD student, but a first-generation university student more generally. So how did that kind of colour in your experiences for you as an undergrad, as a master's, and then as a doctoral student as well?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's coloured this whole kind of university experience in general. I think it was maybe a little bit easier in my undergrad and even my master's studies to kind of find my way because, you know, there's a lot of students around you in a way. So you kind of get feedback from these group settings that you're in and you're kind of writing exams together and you're going to classes together. So in that sense, being a first generation academic and a first generation university student, you kind of find solace in this group dynamic, you know, and you have this support structure. Whereas taking that step into doing a PhD where you really are doing your own independent research, you're having your first experience of submitting to conferences and submitting your work to journals, and then all of a sudden having your work rejected and told that it's really terrible and all these kinds of things. And of course, I have amazing supervisors that have really guided me and helped me. But I think for people who maybe aren't first-generation academics, where maybe these conversations with parents or with siblings or aunts and uncles kind of happen in more informal settings, they kind of get exposed to the everyday kind of nuances of academia that I wasn't exposed to. And so there's just little things that I've kind of had to learn along the way. You know, I didn't really know what a postdoc was even. I really learned what that was when I got here. And yeah, just like little things that I picked up along the way.
Now, how did that tie into your plans to apply for a PhD in the first place?
Yeah, I think, look, I purely just enjoyed what I was doing. And so I've luckily had parents, for example, that were always supportive of the fact that, you know, of course, do something that's going to set you up well for the future, but you also need to love what you do. You know, it needs to make you happy, and it always did, which is why I decided to carry on. My master's supervisor as well was just so incredibly inspiring, and was just a really strong female figure to look up to as well. So I thought, you know, I would love to follow in her footsteps one day. She's wonderful. This actual applying to the PhD in the Netherlands, that was quite a weird experience as well, because in South Africa, you apply to do a PhD, but it's very much self-funded. You can apply for scholarships or bursaries or something, and you'll luckily maybe be able to get one. But more often than not, if you have the funding, you'll find someone to work with, and you'll do a PhD and you'll work on some kind of project that you enjoy. So applying for my PhD in the Netherlands, I had no idea that PhDs in Europe, and I don't know that much about American academic systems, so I can't say the same for them. But at least I know PhDs that are wanting to work in Europe are applying for so many different PhD positions, getting rejected very often, hopefully getting their lucky break. Whereas for me, I had a PhD lined up in South Africa, and I had some funding that was hopefully going to come through for me. And then all of a sudden, I opened my email inbox one morning and I saw this advert for this PhD that I'm doing now. And I saw the names and I saw the topic and I thought, oh my gosh, like this is so directly aligned to everything that I have been doing and want to do. And it was a complete shot in the dark. I thought, okay, well, what do I have to lose? Let me just apply and see what happens. And then I got it. And then I was on a plane to the Netherlands. So I'd done no research about what academia was like in the Netherlands. I didn't have this, you know, normal experience of applying for so many different positions at a European university, for example. So yeah, I mean, that was me just being incredibly unprepared for the experience here. So in that sense, I had to find my way. But then, of course, you know, if you do have a family that has been more academically inclined, then maybe I also just would have been more aware of this kind of stuff in general.
Well, either way, it sounds like a fantastic shot in the dark. And we're glad to hear that you made it in. And you're involved in a group project there at Utrecht called the Ethics of Socially Disruptive Technologies, right? What are the aims of this project?
I mean, I'm based at Utrecht University, but I think what is so special about this Ethics of Socially Disruptive Technologies research program, which is a mouthful, so we call it ESDIT for short. So what is really special about this project is that there are multiple universities involved. So it's a huge research project that involves all the tech universities here. So we've got Delft, we've got Eindhoven, we've got Wageningen, and we've got Twente as well. And then Utrecht is involved too. So yeah, I'm based at Utrecht and I'm kind of employed by them, but the funding is from ESDIT. And as for the goals of the project, it's really, really interesting because, I mean, as the name suggests, we're looking at socially disruptive technologies, but we have all these different research lines and different projects that look at very specific technologies and the kind of impact that they have on society, for example. So we have people that are looking at technology and nature, for example, climate change technologies in the environmental line. We've got people in my research line, so we're in the human condition line, and we look at how different technologies change our understanding of what it means to be human. We have the society line, who also has quite a political element, so people that are looking at how technologies might impact our understanding of democracy, for example. So it's really interesting. And then, yeah, people that are looking at very specific concepts, for example. And yeah, so there's a lot going on. It's really interesting.
And how does your research fit into that?
Right. So my PhD project is on the ethics of humanoid robots. And so I'm part of the human condition research line within the broader project. And the goal from the beginning has really been to investigate how these robots that look realistically human-like and have this human-like AI in the sense that, you know, we can interact with them and they behave like us and they're kind of like these embodied chatbots in a way. if this might change our understanding of what it means to be human. And of course, the very topic of what it means to be human is incredibly broad. So I've really narrowed it down to looking at the concepts of moral status, for example. I'm very interested in the concepts of moral patency when it comes to these humanoid robots, how we interact with them, whether we should feel obligated to treat them in a certain way or if we shouldn't treat them in certain ways. And yeah, so that's broadly the kind of theme that it takes.
Yeah, well, we'll delve into that in just a moment, but I want to ask, maybe just for people who don't know, this includes myself, where are we at with humanoid robots as a society? What can we do with them already?
Yeah, so we definitely are not at Westworld yet. So Westworld, for people who don't know, is just this really amazing series that has these very realistic humanoid robots that people can interact with in these very realistic ways. So we aren't quite there yet. They're not as sophisticated, but the intention is there, right? It's the case of thinking about, okay, if we do one day have these very sophisticated technologies, then what? What are we going to do? But the status quo at the moment is we have humanoid sex robots, for example, which I've also done a little bit of research on, these robots that are designed to just be our companions, you know, for people who, for whatever reason, don't feel comfortable interacting with human beings, or it's just their preference, for example. This idea of care robots, people that who are maybe sick or vulnerable or differently abled, instead of having human care workers look after them, there's this idea that maybe it would be more financially viable to have robots look after them. So yeah, there's a lot of different avenues or kind of parts of society that these robots could fit in. But I guess I'm just more interested in the whole companionship side more than anything else.
So you mentioned that, you know, there's avenues that this kind of research project could take in the future when we get, you know, closer to this kind of Westworld context. But you said that you're interested in researching, you know, how companionship with humanoid robots bears on what it means to be human in today's world with today's developments. I guess the skeptical question could go something like this. I mean, if humanoid robots today are not conscious, if they're not fully fledged persons, if they lack moral patience, then in what sense could they bear on what it's like for us to be human? And in what sense is their companionship anyway? What can you do with the research in today's context?
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, any kind of relationship, and I say relationship in inverted commas, because it is obviously questionable whether that is even the right term to use when it comes to this kind of dynamic. It is very one-sided. Mm. The thing is, I mean, so they're not conscious, they're not sentient, they don't have an understanding of the human condition and what it means to be human. But we are already, even though we don't have these very sophisticated robots yet, we are already seeing cases of people who really do feel something for these robots and relate to them as if they have emotions and as if they have consciousness and sentience. And this isn't only in the case of humanoid robots, but social robots in general. So social robots are robots that can maybe take the form of a dog, for example, or like a baby seal. There's this paro robot, for example, that looks like a fluffy baby seal that they use in care homes as well, or less realistic human-like robots. And there's a very interesting study also done by Kate Darling with Pleo, robotic dinosaur as well, where she says people really feel this genuine kind of kindness and empathy for these robots. So we have these human emotions towards them, even though they can't reciprocate it. And for me, this really does say something really important, and that we really do need to think about, you know, the nature of our interactions with these robots.
Mm. In what way should we think about our interactions with these robots? Do you feel that there's something that goes amiss in terms of these asymmetric relationships between us and robots, you know, me thinking of a robot as my companion and, you know, imparting onto them all these assumptions about what it is to be a person, and then not, is the thought that their interactions with us are a poor substitute for the real deal, for the full human interaction. What would you say about that? Yeah.
Yeah, so that is definitely one element of it. It speaks to a paper that I wrote on this whole Ubuntu African philosophy perspective, which argues that as much as we might relate to these robots as if they're human and have some kind of strong feelings towards them, that they aren't a substitute for human relations because that relationship is non-reciprocal. And that could negatively impact us in many ways. So, I mean, I don't know, we can maybe get to that a little bit later. But generally, in the literature on robot ethics, there is this concern about robots potentially kind of crowding out human relations and the kind of impact that would have on us kind of going out into the world and interacting with other people. Would it impact the nature of our relations with other people as well? So that is definitely an element of concern.
Okay, so certainly an element of concern. I mean, I understand then that, okay, these relationships are different if they're not reciprocal. And okay, maybe there's a concern as well that they might crowd out human relationships. But to take the skeptical approach again, perhaps we might say, well, maybe these kinds of relationships have their own benefits. Maybe they, in some senses, are better than human-human relationships. I don't know why we might say that, but there might be grounds on which we might say that. Why is it that then you're taking the angle that this is a cause for concern, right? That there's something missing here. This is something we should be worried about.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it really depends on the kind of framework that you take. So my concern has been speaking from this whole African philosophy, Ubuntu perspective, is that this reciprocal relation between human beings, where we have these other regarding traits, and then other people have other regarding traits towards us. So what I mean by other regarding traits is just showing kindness towards you and you showing kindness towards me, for example, or, you know, yeah, helping you when you need help or something like that. Generosity, for example, that is really important in building the sense of community between people. When it comes to Ubuntu, for example, there's this kind of quote that gets thrown around a lot, that a person is a person because of other people. And so there's this understanding that we aren't just biological beings, but we are moral beings as well, in the sense that through interacting with people and through these other regarding traits, we improve upon our own morality such that we become the best moral versions of ourselves. And it is this very reciprocal relationship, right, that we can only experience with other human beings. We can't experience it with humanoid robots because they can't reciprocate that. So at least within that philosophical framework, that is where that concern comes in. But of course, in the literature, there is discussion about ways in which these humanoid robots could be extremely beneficial. So there are cases of robots that have been designed, for example, to interact with children with autism that maybe really struggle to communicate with other human beings. But then they did the study where they found that children with autism were far more comfortable interacting with this robot. And it really boosted their confidence and then the hope that they hoped that this robot would kind of be this gateway to them, these children becoming more comfortable interacting with other people. So there's that benefit as well. So in that way, that relationship can be seen as meaningful in the sense that it's a stepping stone to really helping these children communicate. So this literature, it's really exploded. It really depends on the kind of framework that you use. But I'm very aware that there are obviously pros and there are cons. And I think the famous philosophy answer when it comes to these kinds of things is always it depends.
That's great. So before we wrap up, I'm curious about how this concept of Ubuntu and how that guides, you know, how you're thinking about the ethics of human-robot interactions, how that differs from a sort, let's say, a more individualistic concept. I take it the concept of Ubuntu is quite social, like thinking of our roles as social, as moral.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess sort of like sharpening up what Lewis was suggesting was that on some level of description, whether there's anything wrong with these relationships, at least according to the individualistic Anglo-American sort of liberal political philosophy is, you know, as long as these persons' preferences are satisfied or they're living in line with what they think is valuable, to which they kind of, what they endow with value is valuable. Mm-hmm. Does the Ubuntu concept go a little more objective and say, well, it's not quite just what the individual thinks is valuable. How would you contrast those two? Just because I take it for a lot of our listeners, they probably wouldn't have heard of this Ubuntu concept.
Yeah, that's a difficult question. I think with this whole more kind of individualistic notion, I haven't really looked at it so much in terms of, because this Ubuntu paper really looked at how our interactions with these humanoid robots would affect our own moral personhood and potentially how it would impact how we relate with other people. So that relational dynamic was really front and center. The more individualistic aspect and the very clear contrast has come through more when we start thinking about the moral status of these robots themselves and how within these relations or relationships or however you want to term it, how we should think about this dynamic in a way, if there warrants some kind of moral treatment when we are and do experience this kind of companionship with them. So as far as this individualistic notion is concerned, that has really come in when thinking about whether these robots have moral status, because then we start thinking about, okay, on an individual level, what is it that makes human beings ethically unique in the sense that we have full moral personhood, for example? Is it our consciousness? Is it our rationality? Is it our free will, for example? Is it our sentience or these capacities to feel specific emotions? Then on that individualistic level within these relations, then we could say, okay, well, robots don't have these capacities. They don't have full moral status. Therefore, whatever relationship we have with this robot, it doesn't have moral status. We can treat it however we want to treat it, right? It doesn't feel anything. But the very interesting thing is that when we bring this relational aspect into it, then we start thinking, okay, well, individually, these robots don't have consciousness, but does it mean anything if we relate to it as if it has consciousness? That we identify with it as if it is human in a way? Does that mean this robot should be granted some kind of moral status? And how does that impact how we think about this relational dynamic between human beings and robots? I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it certainly does. And on that note, I'm sad to say, Cindy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Philosopher's Nest. You can find our website at www.philosophersnest.com. And if you're a graduate philosophy student who might like to come on and join us for an episode, feel free to reach out to us at thephilosophersnest@gmail.com.